trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
You think that one person has all the answers?
Don't!
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cult extreme belief and the abuse of power from two lizard people who've actually experienced it. Thought of that one on the fly.
Woo! Couldn't tell at all.
I am Lola Blanc. I swear I'm not a lizard person.
And I am Megan Elizabeth. It is yet to be discovered.
Today, our guest is Frank Mink, who wrote a book called Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. And about whom, apparently, or on whom, I guess, American History X is based.
I love loosely. That movie. I love Frank. He's really cool.
Okay, so he's going to tell us about how he joined a skinhead gang and became a white supremacist leader when he was a teenager. He's going to talk to us about how he was indoctrinated at age 13, how he lived a teenage life of crime and violence, and even had his own skinhead public access show.
Crazy. It's like racist PBS.
And then he's going to tell us how he went to prison for an act of violence, made friends with the people he was supposed to hate, and realized that his white supremacist beliefs were horribly, horribly wrong. We'll also get into where he's at now and his current anti-racist beliefs.
Yep, it's so important. Whew, Lola.
Yes, Megan.
What's the cultiest thing that happened to you this week?
Okay, well, I'm going to be really vague, but there have been some interesting group dynamics happening in my life past month. I think you're aware of some of them.
I am.
There's a group that I'm in, and whatever, it's just drama, shit happens. But, you know, I have such a, despite everything, despite how much of a cynic I am and a skeptic and all that shit, I still, in my heart, am kind of an idealist and kind of like believe that operating in groups can be good and great, and I, you know, and I constantly seek that out. I mean, albeit, you know, not in any extreme way, but like just socially and professionally. And it just always goes wrong, man. Something always goes wrong, and it doesn't have to end the group, of course, but it just bums me out because I feel like healthy communication isn't happening.
Yeah. So it feels a little bit like you're on the outside of the cult almost.
Yeah. Or almost as though they're viewing me like I'm a cult leader and like, or like a little bit of villainization going on. I could be totally wrong, but without proper communication, my brain is just left to speculate, you know? Yeah, it just bumps me out. So I was talking to my therapist about it.
Of course, Nat.
And did we talk about the rhyme thing yet?
No.
Okay, so he taught me a rhyme.
Okay.
He teaches me a lot of rhymes. My therapist is very into rhymes. This particular rhyme is forming, storming, and norming.
Whoa.
It is about small group dynamics, and it is exactly what it sounds like, basically, where a group forms, somebody sort of naturally takes the leadership position just because of the particular dynamics that are going on. Somebody emerges as the leader, no matter what. This is just kind of how small groups work. And then the people who maybe weren't in that position tend to become resentful or, you know, decide that they are no longer happy with the leadership, regardless of whether it was like intentional or chosen or not. And storm the leadership, essentially. And at that point, either the group dissolves and is no longer a group, or, you know, they communicate and come to understandings and basically create new norms. And that's the norming phase. I think it's like a little bit more complex than that. When I Googled it, there were like two other additional norm, like words. But I just thought that it was interesting, and it makes me feel kind of
validated.
Not even validated, actually, kind of just depressed.
Cool.
I mean, who knows if that's actually what's going on, or it could very well be that you know, people are just having a rough time right now. I don't know, but I suspect there's some resentment happening. But the reason it's depressing is because it kind of feels like humanity is doomed to just follow these patterns always. And I'm like, I want to be able to like transcend these animalistic, you know, patterns that we have it's like we're a pack of fucking dogs.
I know.
And there's nothing you can do about it. Like, this is just how it works. But I'm like, I want to be, I mean, I just wrote an essay about this, so the dog analogy is fresh in my mind. But I want to be better than the dog, you know? I mean, I love dogs. I wish that we could be more evolved than that. That's all.
Yeah. Well, it'll happen. I really, group dynamics is one of the most complicated things, I think, on the planet, especially when they're smaller for some weird reason. So I have so much empathy for what you're going through. My cultiest thing of the week is not quite so serious.
I'm sorry. I'm fucking serious, Megan.
No, I appreciate it. I'm kind of wishing I had a different one, to be honest. Mine did spark an argument, which was essentially we're watching the new show, The Flight Attendant. Have you seen it?
No.
It's magnificent.
I've heard good things.
Okay, so we're watching it, and somehow this TV show strikes up a conversation of what airline is best. Now, I won't go into what airline I choose to fly and why, because quite frankly, it's embarrassing.
Does that means it has to be Spirit? If that's
it's not Spirit. But It was like a very deep, like, why are you insulting my airline? That's what I fly. Do you know what I mean? And it was just so primal. And I thought his airline was stupid and he thought my airline was stupid. And it was just really, I feel safer on a particular airline.
You have brand loyalty.
I have, but to an extreme where I feel like my physical safety and just emotional safety almost, because that's what my family flies, or if my family buys me a ticket home, that's what I'm flying on. So I became very defensive, and he did as well. So it was just another interesting example to me of how deeply even our most silly seemingly beliefs really run.
Absolutely. You know, I'm obsessed with like all the logical fallacies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't even name a specific one with that, but it just makes me feel like we're all fated to make stupid ass choices.
Totally.
Defend our stupid ass choices.
And if I go the deepest with it, it's like, oh, that's what my dad flies. That's all it is. My dad flies it. I love my dad. You're saying that airline's stupid, so you're saying my dad is stupid. Fuck you. Right. We're breaking up. Like, what the hell? Oh, God.
I mean, honestly, you're further along than most people that you can at least identify that's why you're feeling that loyalty.
That's true.
Spirit Airlines. Megan loves them.
I do. Hashtag Spirit.
Fuck Spirit. I just want to clarify that this is actually a fuck Spirit position that I'm going to take here.
Yeah. You know, that's our cultiest things of the week. Whatever. We're not leaving the house, so you got to take what you can get. I'm sorry that the flight attendant was my only interesting culty moment of the week, but that's what we're dealing with here. And it really is proving to me how full of brimfire I am for my small opinions. So
that's what we love about you, Megan.
Yep. It's full of fire and brimstone.
All right. Well, on that note,
yes,
let's get talking to Frank.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome, Frank Mink. So excited to talk to you.
Thank you.
Let's start at the beginning. So your childhood was kind of rough, not the most stable family in the world. Do you want to just walk us through just early childhood stuff before you are introduced to the neo-Nazi lifestyle?
Sure. Absolutely. You know, I came up with a single parent mother. We were on welfare. We struggled when I was a kid. I remember having to go to store food stamps and being truly embarrassed at that. And I grew up in South Philadelphia, like in a little Irish Catholic neighborhood where everybody knows your business. We're all related. Like, I would go to my grandma when I was a little kid and be like, Grandma, I like Susie Q. And she'd say, Susie Q from 4th Street? She said, yeah, Susie Q from 4th Street. She got your third cousin to vote you in. Bastard, don't touch her. Right? So, like, that's how close our neighborhood was, right? You can't date in the neighborhood, can't date out of the neighborhood. But everyone knew your business, and I just remember always feeling like everyone knew that we were poor. Like, I had food stamps, and I was just kind of embarrassed of that. My mom got remarried. I thought we were going to have a stable life, and the guy was just not a good human being. And I was a drug addict, alcoholic. My mom had had me with an Italian man, because I'm half Irish, half Italian, so what I was told my whole life. My stepdad used to always say he was going to beat the Italian out of me.
Oh my God.
And the Irish didn't get along. So anyway, I got through it. They kicked me out when I was 13, and I moved in with my real dad. My real dad is just a guy who had a bar. He was like the manager of this bar in the hood. I'm talking, it was all like a crack dealer. It was crazy. It was a bar. It was in Philadelphia. It wasn't always sunny. And it was pretty crazy. And so I grew up around that. And then I went to an all black school that year when I was 13, fist fighting all the time. And the fear that my stepdad had put in me started to turn to hate.
Mm.
Right. Because now these other kids are jumping me and fighting me, but they're not beating me half as bad as this dude just was beating me. So I'm cool, like kind of cool. I can fight, I can hand my own, and I can take a punch. So that summer I got to get out of the city, get away from my dad, get away from everything. My dad's neighborhood was no joke, no joke. So I moved up to the Lancaster, Pennsylvania area where my cousin lived. They were originally from South Philly. And I used to go up there a lot to visit because my aunt and uncle, who were great people, moved their kids out of the city. And the kids weren't very happy about it. And so since they were my direct cousins, I would go up and visit. And they lived up where it was all Amish people. Like, really, like, I've never seen that stuff.
Right.
So, like, I mean, and, like, people up in Lancaster, like, the Amish people don't, like, reenact shit because you're coming. Like, they don't sit there and start turning butter. Right. Like, oh, there's all the white people. Right? Like, they really live that way.
Yeah.
And that was National Geographic stuff to me. That was amazing.
Mm.
So, but my cousin who was up there was kind of a punk rock skater kid, and I couldn't wait to hang out with him. I was a little punk rock skater kid, which also led to a lot of the fights at my school. Anyway, I get up there to Lancaster in that area, and my cousin was involved in this neo-Nazi thing. I went into his room. He had all swastika stuff. He had pictures of Hitler. He had newspaper articles about neo-Nazis. He had all that stuff just right there.
So what did you think of that when you first saw all that stuff?
I thought it was interesting. It was cool. I mean, I didn't really have much. I knew about history. I watched McHale's Navy when I was a kid. I knew, you know, there was a world war. I knew this was kind of the bad side of the world war, but it was interesting. I just started reading stuff. And I remember not knowing what the word neo meant in front of Nazi. Mm-hmm. I remember that I was like, what's that mean? And I found out it just meant new, but I didn't know that back then. So it's silly things, right?
Okay. So you're 13, you get to your aunt's house. Your cousin, how did you feel? Was your cousin older than you? He was, right?
Yeah, he was older. He was a couple, two and a half, maybe two years older than me.
Was he someone you looked up to?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I was reading in the book when you say that he introduced you as like a stand-up guy, or one of the guys said, you know, Frank's a stand-up dude. Your cousins told us all about you, and your cousin's just beaming at you, and you feel accepted.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, what happened was, whenever these neo-Nazis were talking about black people, none of them really live around black people.
Right.
So when my cousin would tell these neo-Nazis, yo, my little cousin right here, who's visiting me for the summer, actually lives in like one of the worst, they knew we were from the city, and they're like, he lives in one of the worst neighborhoods.
Mm.
So all these big bad neo-Nazis would talk to me, be like, what's it really like? Like, I mean, I love that attention, right? Them asking me what's it like going to school was, you know, if I walked in my parents' house throughout my life, I walk in, my parents never said, how's your day?
Yeah. Mm.
How's school? How's the game? Like, and this, them asking me, what's it like growing up around black people, with someone saying, yo, how's your day? How's your life?
Just someone caring about taking an interest in you as a person.
Absolutely. So then I started hanging out with them a little bit more. I noticed people fear them, and that I really liked. I mean, I've really seen the look of fear in people's faces when they were around these neo-Nazis, and I'm with them. And I like that, because up until that point, I might be a 14. I'm going on 14 now. I might be a 14-year-old athletic sports kid, because I was a jock, a punk rock jock. You know? But I was athletic and stuff. But really, deep down inside, I was just a fearful little kid. I feared my parents. I feared my step parents. I feared my school. And now someone's like fearing me. Yeah, I liked it.
So you've been experiencing violence this whole time, and now you feel kind of protected from that.
Absolutely. People have just been hurting me, you know, and it's, you know, I know people like don't want to feel bad for a neo-Nazi, a guy who's even a former neo, but just think, I mean, I was just getting my ass whooped all the time, you know, I mean, you know, I was a good fighter. I could fight, but 9 out of 10 times when I was leaving school, sometimes it wasn't fair. My stepfather never fought me fair, you know, just whoopings.
Was your stepfather a boxer? Was I reading that correctly?
Yeah. He would beat me like another guy would beat another guy in a bar brawl.
Wow.
He hit me with jabs. He broke his hand on my head once because he hit me so hard.
Wow.
While I was holding my little sister, who was his daughter.
Wow.
Like, I'm holding her in my arms, and he didn't like the way I was holding her. So he punched me while I was holding her. That's like,
wow.
He just looked for any, he looked for anything for me to do anything wrong.
Yeah.
And the best, people talk about American History X, and we can talk about that later. But if there's a movie called A Boy's Life with Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro. If you ever see that movie, man, it's one of the movies that most made me feel that feeling again of being scared to even go home because of a guy. It's a really good movie. So when these skinheads, though, when they took me this one night, they took me and just started telling me, like, when was I going to shave my head? Because I had, like, this little punk rock haircut. They're like, when are you going to shave all this off your head? And for them to even ask me like that was cool. And then my cousin kind of was like, yeah, you know, he's cool. And that night I looked at them and I was like, well, let's do it now, guys. And they had a pair of clippers there. And each guy that was there that night did, like, one row of my head. Mm-hmm. And another guy would take the clippers. The next guy would do a row of my head. And I'm the young guy, you know. I'm the young guy in this group. Now, I had the hatred for the Black and Latino kids just because of school. You know, I already had this little built-up hatred. Wrong or right, that's just what was going on in my life. So I got that racism. But when they started to talk about the Jews, you know, the only thing I'd ever heard when I was a kid, and I'll never forget this, was my uncle one time told me, he said, he was talking to his other friends, and I came out and I heard him say, yeah, it was around a store and Johnny tried to Jew me. And everyone laughed, you know? And I remember asking my uncle what that meant. I was like, what do you mean? Like, what's Jew you? Why is that funny? And he tried to explain it to me. He goes, well, see, Frank, the Jews, they're notorious for money. He's like, you know what? You'll get that joke when you're older. You'll get that joke when you're older.
Mm.
And I'll tell you, when I was sitting in this meeting, my first like kind of neo-Nazi meeting, which was just in a guy's apartment in Reading, Pennsylvania, I'm sitting in this meeting and these guys start talking about the Jews. And they start talking about how the devil came to Eve and he didn't get there to take it of fruit. He got the true knowledge. That isn't what happened. They say the devil got her to have sex with him and impregnates her with Cain. And Cain is not of Adam and Eve. He's fake. That first she runs off to Adam after she gets impregnated by the devil. This is their version now.
Mm-hmm.
She gets impregnated by the devil. That's the sin. And then she runs and she goes and tries to have sex with, sorry, that's a train going by. Because I'm right by a train. So anyway, she had sex with this devil, got impregnated with Cain, and then ran back to Abel and had sex with Abel. And that's where she got him to partake in the sin. And then she did that because she had Cain and she wanted to trick Adam into thinking Cain's his. So already in their story, we got a Maury Povich episode going on, like, right? But they, if you ever look, you will see where they say the Jews are the seed of Satan. And that goes back to that story. With mm-hmm. all that being said, in that time, I'm at that meeting. This guy starts to talk about how the Jews are secretly with this government called ZOG, Zionist Occupational Government, which is the secret, you know, covenant of the Jews that run the world, that they come and siphon money off the Federal Reserve and they give that money to Israel. And then Israel is going to cause World War III. Now, why he's saying this to me, all I remember is that it unlocked the joke.
Mm.
I got the joke now. And I always want to know, by this time, I want to know what all the adults left. To me, I felt like they left me to fend for myself. So I want to know everything the adults know. I want to know, if they ever say, why you believe in this stupid stuff, I want to be able to shut them down. There's a lot of people that get into this stuff. I got into this for survival. Some people got into it to piss their parents off. They got into the neo-Nazis to piss off the Black kids at school, whatever. I'm telling you, I grabbed onto this thing for survival. And I listened to every word they said. And I truly got into this. I truly would have been a Timothy McVeigh. Absolutely.
Really?
And so that's, yeah.
Timothy McVeigh, for anyone who doesn't know, was an extremist domestic terrorist responsible for the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing.
And so I did anything the movement wanted, any types of hits, robberies, whatever.
I just want to back up a little bit because there's one story that I read that it painted a really clear picture to me. You go to a punk show and you still have your long hair and you're with all the skinheads. Well, I guess what I find really interesting is that there aren't actually any people of color around you guys. So you've decided that these long hairs are the enemy mm-hmm. because there's no one really else to be against where you live. Can you just tell us about the like rivalry with the long hairs?
Yeah. So and that was the part where I seen people that feared the neo-Nazis was that night. But look, I mean, in Lancaster County at the time, there was, I don't know, percentage wise of what was black, but it was a tiny, tiny percentage. There was definitely more Amish people. Mm-hmm. And so, and Amish people don't go to the nightclubs. Mm-hmm. So these neo-Nazis, as they're all gathering together, they have to find a common enemy, right? I mean, these are people that just hate. I mean, and I'm becoming one of them. But, and so, you know, they even talk about when they give, if white people ever got their own homeland here in America, they would just break up quicker anyway, because they just, hate's got to hate. And so these guys would get in these nightclubs and they would hate on the punk rock kids. They would hate on the skater kids. They'd hate on the long hair kids. I mean, look, the long hair kids at the time, you've got to remember the time now, it's 1989, 88, 89. The other white hairstyle that's coming out is the mullet. So we have a right to be against them. Okay. I'm just saying, even to this day, I still stand against the mullet. So,
yep. Mm-hmm.
So we were actively, we look for people with mullets, say at a concert or something, you know, it just, you know, just something to be honest, like a cat looking for a toy.
Yeah. It's really, when your ideology is hate, where does it end? It doesn't. And obviously we'll get more into that later, but I find it fascinating that like, there's not, when there's no one around that is technically in the group that you're supposed to hate, they just find other groups always. Yeah. It's never ending.
Yep. It'll break down by religion. It'll break down by, you know, you name it. So many different things.
Something interesting to me was their fashion and how organized was the group? Was there meetings at a certain time every week? And what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, we went by the very English style, a lot of working class clothing. The Doc Martens are English working class. Everything is English working class. And that's how the style of skin, you know, skinheads weren't racist. I mean, that's not how they started. They weren't neo-Nazis. They were kind of the wannabe black kids in England, really. I mean, this is the God's honest truth, who were these like working class kids that were on welfare, who like smoked pot and listened to reggae music. That was kind of the first skinheads. They were the rebellious little urban kids in England.
Like when did that begin?
That began like in the probably in the early 60s. In fact, there's a song by Elton John, who obviously Elton John is not a neo-Nazi, but he has a song called Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting. That song refers and is talking about skinheads and mods. He says, my sister looks cute in her braces and boots, which is a skinhead term. Mm-hmm. My sister looks cute in her braces and boots, a handful of grease in her hair, getting ready to fight. So it was just an English punk rock thing. And then the National Front came in and started recruiting. And then also the socialist movements, the communist groups started recruiting these kids. And that just made a split between all these factions of neo-Nazis.
Mm. Yeah, there's all the different like subsections. You were talking about how you were confused because you thought skinheads included black people because there was like an anti-racist group of skinheads. Mm-hmm. Where you grew up.
Yeah, the first skinheads I think I ever seen before I became a neo-Nazi. I seen skinheads maybe 6 months earlier. I was skateboarding down South Street in Philly, which was a punk rock, you know, skateboarder skinhead street. And it was cool. It was an old cool punk rock street with skateboard shops and punk rock shops. And anyway, I remember going down there one time, and the first time I really seen skinheads, they had two black guys with them. So when I seen these neo-Nazi skinheads, but I had seen the Geraldo thing. So the Geraldo thing had already set that I knew that there was anti-racist and white power skinheads by the time I kind of met up.
Gotcha. Geraldo is referring to the 1988 episode of the daytime talk show hosted by Geraldo Rivera, in which they spotlighted skinheads against racial prejudice. Okay, so tell us about, now you're in it. You're in this group. You have this community. You're feeling more confident as a person and basically start getting deeper into the ideology. Tell us about the show. Tell us about that period.
Yeah, so I quit going to high school at 14. Like I got kicked out of high school and just never re-registered to go back. Like I was in there for 2 weeks. So I moved in with the movement. Like I moved and lived up in like the compounds and I had nowhere else to go. And I, you know, that's where I wanted to go. I would go up to Bible studies. We'd have Bible studies where we'd learn about how I am now a soldier for God. We go up, we shoot guns at targets of people, and then we go and read the Bible and learn everything that we're doing right now is being proud Aryan Christian soldiers with marching orders from God to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, which is America.
Mm.
So, you're taking a welfare kid from South Philly and you're telling me that God wants me on this team. And then when they would tell us the stories about Adam and Eve, and now again, I was born and raised Irish Catholic. I never once heard them stories out of the Bible from Father Wassel or Sister Mary Agnes. They never told me that story with the devil having sex with Eve. Like, I never heard that shit. When I would question things and say, oh, how come I never heard that? They say, because God chose you to know it now, Frank. Mm. You've been learning from the devil, you know, because they hate Catholicism. It's a Jewish worship. It's a Jew worshiping religion, they would say. You've been lied to your whole life. Like, here's the truth. And again, to tell a guy who has nothing going on in my life, you're going to tell me that, like, I'm part of this bigger team. And
right. This
is how you build radicals. This is how you build Islamic terrorists. I mean, it's the same tool, it's the same thing. And like, they don't, you got to think, like, these people that are neo-Nazis don't think that they're bad. So we can't think like, oh, they're like, yeah, I'm going to get this guy to go do a bombing. They just think they're preaching the peace. They're preaching the truth, not the peace. They're preaching the truth, right? So, and that they're trying to shed light. So I know it's really hard sometimes when people are like, here when they talk about the Bible and you're like, I mean, don't you know you're evil by saying this stuff in the Bibles like this? But we don't. We absolutely don't know. We think it's just like the Trumpers. They don't know that they believe in a madman right now. Right. They don't know that.
Right.
They think that this is right and good.
Yeah.
And that's how I felt for a long time. Yeah. So I get into this and I'm starting to preach and I wound up running all across the country. I wound up living in a safe house in northern Indianapolis. I was wanted by the police in Philadelphia and my movement got me out of town. So I wound up popping back up in Indianapolis, wound up meeting up with some other neo-Nazis in Illinois. This time I'm traveling just randomly around the country, like catching rides, or I, you know, sold some guns. So I had some money and I would just get on buses and go wherever. And I'm 16 years old.
What were you wanted by the police for?
An assault. I think it was probably assault, battery, and a robbery on that one. I think they wanted me for.
Okay.
So, and then another one for my arrest in Wildwood, New Jersey, too, for a fight and for a robbery.
And are these robberies like stick ups, or are they like just people on the street? Like, what is that?
Well, one was kind of a stick up. And it was all under the guise that it's for the movement. Like, I mean, it was all, but you know, really anyone was against us was our enemy. So I got to do whatever I wanted to anybody.
Gotcha.
If you weren't part of our movement. I'm 16. I wound up trying to kill myself. That just shows you what was really inside me at the time. I mean, and that's like my second or third attempt as a teenager.
Really?
I hated Christmas. I hated everything. I tried to kill myself. I was in Terre Haute, Indiana. I got put in a mental hospital, wound up having to break out of the mental hospital to get out of going back to Philadelphia with my warrants. They found my warrants in the hospital while I was in the hospital.
You broke out of the mental hospital? How did you get out?
Yeah. My buddies came in the middle of the night from Illinois and broke my window. Like, they didn't even break it all the way. They just spider webbed it. It was a big, long window that was in my room. My room actually overlooked the parking lot. I was like up on the second story. And I think they shot through the glass finally put a hole.
Wow.
And so I put all my furniture against my door to keep from the the big orderlies coming in and getting me. Well, I went and I put all my furniture against the door. And when they came to my door, I was trying to like find some other way so I didn't have to jump out the damn window. I was going to try and climb down on this blanket or something. My door, like most hospitals, my door pulls open. So when they pulled open my door, my furniture was just sitting there. They're like, what are you doing? You know what I mean? And I was like, oh. So I just leaped. I took the leap and I went through a tree. I landed and got up, started running. Yeah, this is all factual stuff. I mean, when we wrote my book, I put a whole big thing about how we went to all these locations and asked other people's eyewitness accounts to these. And so most of that story that's in my book about that breaking out of the mental hospital isn't even my version. It's other people's versions.
That's crazy. Okay. So you're on the run. You're 16 and on the run.
I'm on the run. And I make it, I pop up in Springfield, Illinois, home of Abraham Lincoln, or everything about Abraham Lincoln at Springfield, Illinois. And so I move there and I'm trying to stay low because I have the warrant. And I wound up getting into a fight with some anti-racist skinheads and other people that we've seen at a mall one day. We've seen them. They've seen us. Now, you got to remember at this time, I got a big swastika tattooed on my neck already. I got that when I was 15.
Oh, wow. So, okay.
So people kind of, I mean, I'm not the biggest guy, but I don't know. So these guys kind of ran from us and we wound up catching them in the mall. right outside. And, you know, it was altercation. And the police came and arrested us for it. And when they arrested us, they found my warrants. At that time, they didn't charge me as an adult or a child, or a juvenile or adult yet. They just brought me in, and I'm like waiting in this holding cell. And they find the warrant or something, and they call back to Philly. And they're like, hey, we got this guy. And they're like, well, it's a juvenile warrant. Like, we're not going to send four states away for a freaking juvenile on a strong arm. You know, it was not a strong arm robbery. It was just an assault and battery, I think, with intent to rob or something like that. So anyway, they're like, we're not going to send away. They're like, why don't you guys just take care of them? You know, like charge them up, whatever. And they dropped the warrant on me. Or dropped whatever they had for me. They dropped it. So the police in Illinois wound up dropping that case on me, and they let me out of jail like the next day. And they're like, oh, by the way, you don't have any more warrants for your arrest. So because of this one little fight, I got out of something I've been running from for about a year.
Wow. Right?
Because of this one little fight. And then I go crazy. And then I start recruiting like crazy. I'm out there. Like, I go back to who I was, like I was doing in Philly. In Philly, I was a big recruiter. I was always getting people to the movement, always getting people to do things. Even I was like 15, I was running like 19-year-old dudes, no lie. I mean, so I got out to Springfield. Now we got a TV show on cable access, which was the big thing back then. We got like a racist Wayne's World going.
Tell us about the show. What, like, racist Wayne's World is a pretty clear description, but can you, like, what would you have guests on? Like, what was it?
Yeah, we'd have guests. We had our own people dress up like Hicks and sing songs, and we make fun of the KKK because we didn't like them anymore, because they were like, they're old school, we're new school, F them.
Oh, wow.
And we used to like do like songs and skits and tell jokes. I mean, it wasn't, because there was other neo-Nazi shows out at the time, but they were so boring. So I'm doing all this.
Damn.
Recruiting like crazy out of the high schools there. Recruiting like crazy. Then news does a couple articles on me, does a couple, you know, television pieces on these new neo-Nazi group with the TV show. Everyone's intrigued. I'm recruiting like crazy, but I tell you, I'm a broken human being. Like, I'm an egomaniac with no self-esteem, who was a complete alcoholic by the time I was 15 or 16, by the way. It's hard to put that all in the mix, but which for my neighborhood, being an Irish Catholic kid, goes par with the course. So I'm an alcoholic neo-Nazi leader at 16, 17, with a huge alcohol problem, a huge ego problem, and no self-esteem whatsoever. So I'm like a very dangerous human being.
Right.
And it's not because I'm so tough that I mean I'm dangerous. I just mean I'm dangerous because I'm broken. Mm. Like, I'm homicidal or suicidal.
Right.
Whatever way the wind blows that day. Right. And so a guy was one of these anti-racist skinhead Antifa type guys was around in Springfield, and my friends were kind of cool with him. And I wasn't real. I was kind of cool with him, but I wasn't that cool with him because he was our enemy. And they just hadn't had that taught to them yet in Springfield. Like, yo, these guys are real, real enemies. Like, it's cool. He's kind of pal around with each other. But on the East Coast, we're brawling with each other, us two groups. You know, like, so let's stick to the game here, right? And I called that guy up and told him to come over for a skinhead Christmas party on Christmas Eve. And he showed up, and we kidnapped him. And we violently beat him and tortured him and asked for a ransom. And we never got no ransom for him. Just didn't work out. So, and there's rules. There's rules when you do the kidnapping thing. Within two hours, you got to have that ransom money. If you don't have it, man, you got to dramatically change the price. And, hopefully it'll meet you. And then after 4 hours, you got to, get rid of the person, either let them go or get rid of them. Right. That's kind of the game. I never, I'm not saying I just know the rules of the game. And, we couldn't get anything. So Christmas morning, we decided it was be a happy holidays if we let him go. So we let him go, and he went to the hospital. He had to get some stitches and stuff. And obviously he tells the police about who did this to him. Obviously the police in Springfield, Illinois, do not like me very much. I'm this guy. On top of my head up here, it says Made in Philly. You just can't see it because my hair, but I do have, it's a tattoo. It says Made in Philly. So they know I'm not a local kid.
Right.
They know I'm a huge troublemaker from outside of the town, coming there, starting all this trouble. And they couldn't wait to get their hands on me. So they arrested me at the next taping of my TV show. I knew the cameraman looked different. And maybe it was the ATF coats. I don't know. So they got me, and they charged me as an adult, and they were not playing with me no more. They gave me a charge of aggravated kidnapping or aggravated unlawful restraint and charged me as an adult.
What was your sentence? How much time?
I'm getting a 3 to 5 year sentence. And I'd already done like 7 months in county, waiting my trial. So that when I got upstate, I had to do about a year or so.
Okay.
But because of my crime being so violent, which it was, and I had a firearm, we had a gun involved in it. I couldn't get a minimum or medium security, which I thought I would, because I was 17 years old. I was the youngest kid in the prison. And for about 2 months, I was the youngest kid in the prison.
Wow.
Until my kid showed up that I knew from the county jail, who was a little bit younger than me, because I was the youngest kid in the county jail, until he showed up in the county jail, this black kid named G. And then he showed up in the same state prison I did after he plea bargained his case. And he got there, and he was a younger kid. And then there was another younger kid that came in later on. But anyway.
So you get to jail. What are the dynamics like? Tell us about it.
So I first get arrested. I had to do time in a county jail, which is not like Mayberry. It isn't like this little like three cell. It's a huge downtown building with like 5 stories, 7 wings. I mean, it was a huge county jail. They held federal inmates there, everything. So I get put in there. They put me in the hole because of my age. And they knew I escaped from a mental hospital. So I wasn't going to get put just somewhere easy, right? They'd heard from other people that I broke out of a mental hospital. Mm. And they'd heard about it anyway. So they put me in the hole. And I sat in there for about 4 or 5 months and went crazy. I mean, you don't get to talk to no one. You get to use the phone maybe once, twice a week. If that, the phone's outside your cell. You get to use the shower once or twice a week. Other than that, you're fed in your cell, and you have no TV, no nothing. You have because you're afraid you'll hang yourself with the cord. You can't have anything. Mm. And I was in there and read a lot of books, read a lot of religious stuff. Started reading the Bible on my own. Started praying to God a little bit more on my own, not praying for a race war. Well, no, maybe take that back. When I first started praying to God, I was insane. So I would pray to God and say, "Yo, God, if if I do this, will you kill all the guards and pop my door and knock down the wall and let me go home? Will you do that for me? All right, God, ready?" And I would do a countdown and all this stuff, right? And so I one day got to reading in the book, in the big book, about I think it was John the Baptist starts to he goes to one of the angels and says, "Why is Jesus not recognizing me?" And I'm not preaching any religion. Just talk about God. But John the Baptist says, why is Jesus not come recognize me yet here at this prison? And God tells him, or the Lord tells him through the angels, whatever, that he should fast. But do not brag or boast that you are fasting, because you are fasting. Going around town when you're fasting for God defeats the purpose. Mm-hmm. So you can't do that. So he goes, it's just like praying, being the man of praise on a street corner. Like you're just the asshole. So I read that in the book, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to fast. I'm not going to eat for a couple of days, but I'm not going to tell the guards, because they would open up my food tray and slide my food through, and I would just slide the food right back out, or I would close the food tray. And they would always say, "Are you refusing to eat?" And I say, "Yeah." And they say, "Why?" And I said, "Can't tell you." But I felt like saying, "You better be prepared, because some shit's going down this weekend. After I get done this fast, you know, you're all dead. I'm out of here." I wanted to tell them. But I said, I can't tell you. And they said, all right. So after 3 days, the warden comes in and says, "Why are you not eating?" Pulls me out of my cell. Says, "Why are you not eating?" And I said, "I can't tell you." He goes, "You're not trying to harm yourself or kill yourself, are you?" And I'm like, no, not at all. He's like, "Okay, well," he goes, "how about this, Mr. Mink? Tomorrow, I'm going to come. And if you eat your breakfast in the morning, so I know you're not trying to hurt yourself, I'll put you in general population." And I already planned on eating the next day. So let me tell you that already. But I made the warden seem like I was like, "Sure, warden, for you. Absolutely. I'll eat tomorrow for you, buddy." So I was going to eat anyway, but I did. And in the morning I woke up and I ate, and the warden walked me out to that to the cell block. And this is one of the defining moments in my life, because in that walk from my old cell block to where I had no freedom, locked down 24 hours. I mean, no 23 in one rule yet. So, I was in my cell all the time. When I was on that walk to the new cell block, there was this feeling that came over to me that God isn't going to give me what I want, but he'll give me what I need. And in that moment, because I had started talking to myself in that cell block, I mean, you're locked up I literally had conversations with myself, and then would catch myself and go, "Oh my God, I'm talking to myself." That's how crazy it was getting in there.
Makes sense.
So I get put in general population and I meet up with this kid G, this black kid G. And this is where kind of American History X kind of kicks in a little bit for people. Like, this is all true. This is my people. This is what happened. This is my story. This kid G was this young black kid, shorter than me. So I remember that. He was smaller than me. He was also younger than me. And one day he came over and he started talking about playing spades and the card game. And he's like, you know how to play? And I was like, no, we're sitting at a table by ourselves. Just, and it's in a big Dave room. It's not like, you know, it's just it's in a county jail cell block. And so anyway, he just starts talking to me one day and he starts showing me how to play spades. And he starts showing me about how to cheat and play and da da da. And he's like, yo, let's go play these guys. Come on, let's go play them for peanut butter and jellies. And I was like, all right, I love peanut butter and jellies. I was like, all right, let's do it. And we went and we cheated and we played. And we won. And then the next day we did the same thing. And anytime there would be new guys come on the cell block, you thought they were great at spades. Like, yeah. And they come in and we'd be like, oh, you know, here's this neo-Nazi. It's like white man can't jump. Like, here's this black kid, a drug dealing black kid, and this white neo-Nazi kid. We're like, hey, we'll play using spades. Like, yeah, sure. And we play and we cheat the whole time. So I wound up getting sentenced. They have a videotape. We videotaped the kidnapping and the torturing. They now have that on as evidence. I'm not too bright. And when I get sent upstate prison, I get sent to maximum security prison. Like, they're not playing with me. And the first prison I get put up in, or the second prison I had to go to, is where John Wayne Gacy was. He was still alive at the time.
Wow.
On death row.
Wow. At the place
where I was. And I seen him once from afar. I mean, I was never near him. You know, he's on death row. And if I was near him, I would have to kill him. Like, because as soon as I get into the prison, I'm automatically part of the white gangs. Like, I mean, because of my ranking on the outside, I have my pick. I swear to you. I mean, it's not, I had a TV show. I had a big swastika on my neck. I had my pick. I just kind of hung out my Aryan Nations and the bikers, and there's the Aryan Brotherhood, and they're part of our crew too. I mean, we did everything with them too, but I wasn't like an Aryan Brotherhood member. I was just an Aryan Nations member, and I hung out with the bikers, and that's who our gang was in there.
So there are multiple white supremacist groups?
Yeah. Well, so in the Department of Illinois Department of Corrections, I'm sorry, what's it called? Everyone kind of falls under what they call the biker gang. All right. So it's just all biker gangs that come in, they all ride together. Like, you may be a mongrel and a Hell's Angel, it doesn't matter. You'll ride together. So, and everyone, no matter if you're a biker or not, you ride under this biker flag, and that's one big gang. And then the Aryans kind of are all intertwined in that gang.
Okay.
Some are Aryan Nations, some are Aryan Aryan Brotherhood, and then there's like Northsiders, which is a big white gang, but they're not like white supremacists. They're kind of just a white gang that kind of runs alongside of us. Okay. Then there's another gang called the Gaylords, which aren't gay. They're not gay. They're just called the Gaylords because it's an old gang name, and they kind of run with the black gangs, but they're white, and they mingle with us too. Then there's another white gang called the Simon City Royals, and they also run with black gangs. But we didn't really mess around with Simon City Royals. Like, if you were a Simon City Royal, you were usually our enemy back then. Mm. So that's how it kind of got broken down.
Wow. It's such interesting dynamics.
So wait, why would you have to kill John Wayne Gacy if you saw him? Just, is that like...
Yeah, he had a hit out on his head.
Oh.
Like, because since he messed with kids... Anybody that messes with kids has a hit on their head anyway. Right. So even though his were like 16, 17, 19, you know, up to 19-year-old boys, there was just a massive, you know, if anyone got a chance, you were to take him out. And and I knew that before I even got to that prison, that like, if we see him, but you don't ever see him. The guy was always in his own cell and his death row, and it's really hard to get there. So,
right.
So that's why. I mean, for all the inmates and all the people that want to hate, even the Aryans, and, you know, there is morals and there is codes in there. And, you know, messing around with children or rape, any of that stuff is very looked very down upon and makes you a potential victim at all time in prison.
Mm.
Me, this is the other thing, me going to prison for kidnapping one of my rivals is like you can't, besides being a cop killer, you can't be any higher in the like pecking form of crimes to go to jail for. I kidnapped my rival, and you know, so I had some clout in there.
Mm. So what if, you know, you're this racist, you're living in this racist ideology, you believe it. So why do you feel comfortable playing games with the black kid?
Because the white dude sucked. they did. Like, it was a bunch of bikers. When you played basketball with a bunch of bikers, like the old Chris Rock thing said, you got to let double dribbling go. You got to let traveling go when you play basketball with bikers. Like, I mean, it was just a brick city all day long, right? I knew how to play basketball. I grew up in Philly, right? I knew how to play football. I mean, I was a very well-known little white wide receiver even growing up before I got into the neo-Nazis. So when I started playing football with somebody, I played football with the bikers, and they were kind of fun. They liked to tackle and get in the mud, you know, they're bikers. But they didn't, like, have any real structure to the game, and there was no rules, just Neanderthal caveman stuff. So when I seen some of the black guys were playing, and it was, like, a neutral day in the yard, and I seen they were, like, lined up in formation. And again, it's tackle, but there's no pads or equipment. It's just, you know, just guys playing in their clothes. You know, I just seen them playing one day, and G and this other kid, Tony, I was cool with, was the quarterback, actually. I was cool with Tony just from being on my same cell block all the time. I played dominoes with him. So, again, there's no race war going on. So people don't mind if you're a white guy playing with black guys. Like, there was no race war or anything at the prison at the time. It was kind of copacetic at the time. A race war had just happened right before I got there. So everyone's kind of cool right now. So, like, when I seen them guys playing football one day, I just was like, I could play. And they're like, yeah, every white boy says that. And then they let me do kickoff returns. It's my first job. And I knew not everybody was going to block for me. Not everyone on that team liked me. You know, I was still a neo-Nazi with a swastika on my neck.
Right.
And I broke the first kickoff return for a touchback. Like, I took it all the way.
I don't know what sports mean, but that sounds like a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, I got a touchdown. I ran it. I got the ball on a kickoff return, ran it up the field, and turned on the Jets, and I did a sick little spin move, and I was just gone. And these guys seen that, like, wow, like, this guy knows how to play. I knew how to rotate the ball. I knew how to do all these other things. So anyway, I just got good at playing ball, and I showed up every time I could. Same thing when I played basketball, and guys were just cool with me. And the white guys that were part of my gang, they knew that I had way more knowledge about the movement than they did, so they never questioned me. You know, I mean, I would go in and start talking about the Jews. These are all bikers who just hate black people, or they hate Mexicans. And I'm coming in, I'm preaching about the Jews and, you know, Leif Erikson and whatever else goddamn shit I pull out of my ass that day. So they never thought I was changing. And I didn't think I was changing neither. I was just being a 17-year-old, about to be 18-year-old, soon to be father, who's doing time, like hard time.
Soon to be father?
Yeah, I had a daughter on the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the whole time I'm in prison, I have a daughter on the way. And then she was born, and when I got out, she was 6 months old. When my daughter was born, a great example, when my daughter was born, I went and I was going to walk on the cell block, and I was going to yell up to some of my Aryans, like, yo, I have my kid, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't. Like, I seen, and because I just didn't want them to be like, oh, now your girl's going to lose that baby weight. She's going to cheat on you. Because that's what gangs say to each other. You know what I mean? Like, fuck. And I just didn't want to hear any of that stuff that day from the bikers. So I turned to my friend G and Jello were walking by me. And I was like, yo, guys. And they were walking in Jello's cell. And I said, yo, I come in and whatever. And they're like, yeah. And they're sitting in their cell. Now these kids I see every day, joke with every day, play football with sometimes, whatever. Just we're cool with each other. And I said, yo, I have my kid. Because I had told them guys playing football when I was playing football and when I was playing basketball with them, when we walked back, we'd always talk about our personal lives together. And they knew that I had a kid on the way. So when I said to them, you have a kid, they were all like, oh, that's what's up. Because they'd known that I'd been talking about my girl about to have the baby. So they're like, that's what's up. And, you know, what she look like and da da da. And so the first people I told them that when my firstborn was born was black people.
Did you notice that was odd at the time?
Well, it was funny though, because it wasn't like they were just, I was just so kind of cool with them guys. Like, they weren't like my best friends, but they were definitely people that if we were sitting around and it was count and we were in the chow hall and like, when they say count time, that means wherever you are, you got to just sit down until they count every inmate. They do it like 3 or 4 times a day, 5 times a day. I mean, like, and if you're like standing in the chow hall waiting and they would say, count, you knew you were going to sit down for about 15, 20 minutes until they counted the whole prison. And I remember there was times when I would see G sit down and I would hurry up and go sit by him, like in the chow hall waiting for count to go. Just because I knew that we would sit there and we would make each other laugh and we'd always bullshit with each other. I mean, he was super funny. Like, he was like a short little Kevin Hart kind of, like, little guy. And so he was like super funny. He always made fun of everybody. Even though everyone wore the same clothes in there, he would bust on you for why, how you wear your clothes and why you wear that stupid. And oh my God, he was so funny. So of course I wanted to sit next to him, you know? you know, I was cool with a lot of the Mexican guys just because I played soccer sometimes. It's another sport I would go out and play once in a while. And it was always the Latino guys that all played soccer. And I played defense. And the chief of the gang, the chief of the big Mexican gang, was the goalie. And I was his defenseman. And he, like, loved me because I'd dive everywhere. I'd head the ball out of play if they were going to score. I mean, he's always, you know, always called me crazy gringo. It was cool. So when I'm getting released from prison, I'm going to go back to being a neo-Nazi. I didn't change in there. This is an American History X. I didn't change in prison. I didn't feel I was changing. I thought, yeah, it's cool. I'm getting along in prison. I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. But when I got out of prison, it just wasn't gelling right. I mean, I was trying to be a dad. And that wasn't working. I'm a convicted felon with swastika on my neck. Her mom's not really feeling it anymore. Broken up with me and had every right to break up with me. I was a horrible boyfriend. So I moved back to Philly. And I got back to Philly. Got right back with all my neo-Nazis. That's all I knew. And I had my old crew back. But things just weren't gelling. I'm telling you, there was times where, like, we'd be at a meeting or a get-together or a party, and some guy would get up to make some speech. And I know the guy. He's like one of my young recruits from years ago. Now he gets up, and he'd say stuff. And he would say things, I swear to you, that he heard from me. You know, things that I used to say. And when he would get up and stand up and say these things, I would go, God, that's so stupid. Oh my God, that's so dumb. Mm. Like, you know, no, all Black people ain't that way. Like, but I wouldn't say in the meeting. I'm not sitting here saying I stood up in front of the whole group and said, no, just in my head, I was like, that's bullshit. Mm-hmm. So I started to make this turn in the fact that I was like, you know what? I'm not going to be real against Black, Asian, or Latino people. Like, I can admit we're all equal. I was in prison with a lot of those people. I got this. I said, but I'm still going to hate the Jews because the Jews keep me part of this. If I could preach just against the Jews, I'm cool. I still get to be a neo-Nazi. I get to keep my clout. I got tons of pull in that movement at the time for being a 19-year-old. Again, I just got home from prison for kidnapping one of our rivals. Again, I show up, I got clout. I'll tell you, on the Jewish thing, when I have a big swastika tattooed on my neck, I got all these tattoos on my head. I got skinhead written across my knuckles. Mm. When you go fill out a job application and you have an aggravated kidnapping already on your record for life,
right,
these ain't good people skills.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? HR isn't lining up to give me management positions.
Right.
So a buddy of mine said he can get me a job carrying in and out antique furniture at an antique show in Cherry Hill, New Jersey for the weekend, $100 a day. And I said to my friend, who was also a neo-Nazi at the time, I said, yeah, I'll take the job. And he goes, but I got to tell you, dude, the guy that owns the company is a Jew. Like, he's like Jewish. I just said to him, I said, well, you told him, he goes, I told him all about you. I said, you don't care what I believe. And he said, Frank, Keith said this. And his name is Keith Brookstein. He goes, Keith said this. He don't give a rat's ass what you believe. Just don't break his fucking furniture. And I showed up and I worked for this guy. And at the end of my 3 days, he owed me $300. I'd already gotten paid like $600 in tips because people tip you as you carry furniture to their cars. And I made like $600 in tips. So when this guy came up to give me my $300, I thought he was going to, you know, my anti-Semitic, ignorant way, he was going to Jew me. And he came up and he said, how much do I owe you? It was the end of Sunday. I said, $300, dude. I'm like, waiting to see if he's going to argue with me, you know?
Mm.
And he just pulled out this money. And it was like, one, two, three, here's 300. He was like, you know what? Here's an extra $100. You're a really good worker. So I made $1,000 in that weekend. And you know, and there's something that we all do as human beings, because we ain't too all far from each other. I might've been a neo-Nazi, but we all have resentments. We all have those grudges and, you know, just on yourself. So you think about it. There's times where you were going to go to work and yesterday Nancy said something that really pissed you off. And Nancy has been in your head. You can't wait tomorrow. You know what? She says that same stuff. You're going to argue with her. You're going to come back at her. You plot the whole argument. You practice in the mirror. You wake up in the middle of the night thinking about Nancy. Mm-hmm. You go to work. Can't wait to see Nancy today. She's probably going to wear her stupid Dallas Cowboys stuff again. Like, all right. You think about Nancy. You go, and then you get to work and you see Nancy and you're like, what's up, Nancy? And Nancy's like, no, what's going on? And you're like, nothing. It's all good. Because we love that part of having the resentment of telling Nancy off in our head. Well, I did that with this Jewish dude. I can't wait to tell this dude off. Mm. He's going to try and rip me off. He's going to try and Jew me. And here it was nothing of the sorts. So then he gave me a ride home and he says, yo, what do you do for a living? I pointed to the swastika on my neck and I said, I don't do anything, man. He goes, well, why don't you come work for me? And I went and I worked for this man. And my other neo-Nazi friend worked for him too.
Wow.
And Keith, like, he didn't take too much time with my other friend, but with me, whenever he had to go pick up furniture, he always be like, Frank, get in the trunk with me. Let's go get this furniture. And it'd be like in North Jersey somewhere. We'd be like 2 hours on the road. He'd be like, hey, Frank, I got to go pick up this dining room set so we could, you know, get it back to the warehouse, get it refinished, get it in the storefronts. I mean, the dude had a big business of redoing antiques. And I'd jump in a truck and we get the Philly paper and I read the what's going on in the O.J. Simpson trial at the time. And I read it to him and we'd talk and talk about life and trial and race. And we just had great conversations all the time. And I started to enjoy these rides. And this guy was not religiously Jewish, but Keith, he would always go, oh, hey, I mean, Upper East Coast Jewish hardcore, you know, and we would just always talk. And I did this one thing, and which led to me knowing it's one of the things that I know that makes me an alcoholic is I always think less of myself. You know, and I know a lot of people do that, but I think about myself too much and I think too less of myself, you know. And so whenever I would make a mistake, I'd always go, oh, Keith, I'm so stupid, you know. And I didn't say like I'm stupid, you know, like a skinny girl will say, oh, my God, I'm fat. So everyone goes, oh, my God, Michelle, you're not fat. Like, I didn't say I'm stupid because I wanted people to say you're not stupid. I just said it all the time. Like, if I messed up, oh, I'm so stupid. And so one day I broke something and Keith, I was like, oh, Keith, I'm so stupid. And he came over and he just gripped me up and he goes, stop saying you're stupid, you fucking idiot. Let's go. And I cleaned up this mess I made and we got in the truck and I went from the fire me because it was a marble top table I broke. It was expensive. And he just unloaded on me. He started telling me about times when he's like, remember when you said this? Remember when you figured this out? Like, that's smart, Frank. That's, you can't pay for that education you got. And I just remember listening to him and just being like so grateful to have this human being in my life. Mm. With a swastika blazing at him every day in the truck. Mm. That day, Keith goes to drop me off. I still have a shaved head. I still wear my neo-Nazi boots every day to this guy's work. And that was the day when he was talking to me and talking to me about how smart I was and just showing me genuine love and concern and also calling me a fucking idiot. When he did that, like, I was so embarrassed of those boots on my feet that day. Like, I just felt it. And there had already been a couple times now where I've been kind of embarrassed about the police. I told you about it. People would say things and I'd go, oh, that's so stupid. This time it was on me. Like, I just was so embarrassed that day. Like, that I still am continuously trying to believe these beliefs, even though God has continuously proven me wrong. Mm. And science has proven me wrong. And I'm reading about the stuff with DNA, about how we're human beings. If I'm wrong. There's just like all these things that are happening that are just like, you're wrong, Frank. You're fucking wrong. And I just got so tired of banging my head against the wall to believe something that I knew at the end was not right. And I would have given my life. I would have been at Timothy McVeigh. No doubt when I was in the movement, I was that guy. Yeah. And then the Oklahoma City bombing happens. Now, I don't know Timothy McVeigh at the time. I use him as a reference now, but I didn't know Timothy McVeigh. I got out of the neo-Nazis for about 8 months. The Oklahoma City bombing happened. And I seen that picture of that dead little girl in that fireman's arms. And I'd already been out of the neo-Nazis, like I said, maybe 8 months at the time. And it just killed me. It just ate me up all the time. Like, every time I thought about what was going on at that time, remember, Oklahoma City bombing happened that day. So it's everyone's thinking about it. Everyone's talking about it. It happened, I think, on a Thursday. And by Sunday, I was so gut-wrenchingly sick with myself for still having a swastika on my neck and not going out and saying that these beliefs are wrong. Like, I just been shut up about it. I just said, I'm not going to talk about it. I just want to get out of that lifestyle and not talk about it. But I couldn't do it anymore when I seen that. So I went to the FBI, told them my story. Never got one person put in prison. That was not my job. I just went there to go tell them, like, you know, I was in and I got out. And they knew all about me. They had files on me, no lie. I mean, they knew all these cases of things that I supposedly had done. And they asked me honestly if I'd done things and if I hadn't. And I said yes or no. I was honest with them, which is something they later on told me. That's why they asked me to start speaking with other groups, because they were like, you were just honest, Frank. So a bunch of people started asking me to come speak for them, some groups, some civil rights groups, some church groups, right? And I was raw. Like, I had no idea. I was just up there. Oh, my God. I don't remember what the hell I used to say. Mm-hmm. But I remember I used to say, like, we used to do a lot of violent stuff, and I don't want that to happen anymore, basically. Like, what goes around comes around was basically, like, the whole tell of my story back then. Like, that I had such a bad karma score. Not a credit score. I had a karma score. It was so bad with God that I was like, I have to get this karma score back up. Mm. So I started just trying to do good things. And I noticed my life would change. And then I noticed I got to meet with the head of the Philadelphia Flyers and his son. And I said, hey, when I was in prison, I played sports, and they gave me 20 sets of equipment, and we started Harmony Through Hockey, where we went around the toughest, one of the toughest cities, and recruited black kids and white kids, but we tried to be more towards black kids playing the game of hockey. And now it got turned into the Ed Snyder Foundation, and it's helped like 10,000 people. And I went on to go do that hockey program for three other NHL teams. I worked in pro hockey for a long time. I worked in the marketing capacity. I worked as a PR for the players. I had a great hockey career from starting that job. I got Harmony Through Hockey going, and every year to this day, when Harmony Through Hockey hasn't happened since the pandemic and stuff, but every year I get at least one or two new kids into a league somewhere. Get donations. We just get them equipped and get them in the league and sign up and get them signed up. Anyway, but I also got really good at coaching. Obviously, I was good at running street gangs, and I got really good at coaching to where I was assistant coach for a major hockey program for a long time, and I was also a coach of another program for a long time. And I won like 12 national championships as a hockey coach.
Oh, wow. Cool.
So I did that for a bunch of years, and I kind of got away from the civil rights stuff as much as I wasn't like speaking out. And there's so many formers now that are out like doing the same thing. And that's great. Like all of us running against this fence and trying to knock down this fence of racism is great. There should be hundreds and thousands of formers, and we all have our different stories and we all have our different things. And I used to do interventions on neo-Nazis like 20 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And then I've done a couple over the years. In 25 years, I've probably done about 25 of them. So maybe one a year.
Okay.
Well, I had a divorce a couple years ago, relapsed in my divorce, then gotten sober and really came to terms. I flew to Los Angeles and met up with a man who I wanted to spiritually guide me through these dozen steps that I had to take to fix myself. And I found, and I got with him. And in that time, I started to learn that this world isn't about me at all, that it's all about being of service to others at all of God's children, black, white, it doesn't. And so 25 years of me not being against racism and preaching out against it, I've done thousands of police crimes, hate crimes training for the police. So I'm involved with the police for a long time. Like, I helped out. I played hockey I was so close with the police. I wound up playing on an all cop hockey team for a men's league for 2 years.
Oh, wow. Bowling.
And then I even helped out in all their charity events, was very much an ally and still would like to consider myself an ally of the police. But right now I don't want to do any speaking for them anymore until what needs to change in this country. And also I want to tell you that throughout them years that all this was going on, I was coaching hockey, getting very into hockey. I kept relapsing. You know, life, I felt like God, I wasn't doing what God wanted me to do. When I finally got sober and I realized what God wanted me to do, and that's to be of service to others, and that's it, and not to think about myself. When this pandemic hit, I actually like cocooned myself in, and I really dedicated myself to getting more spiritual, to learning about the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and who wrote it, and Madison and Hamilton, and all that. Like, I just was like really reading up on all this stuff during the pandemic. And then Breonna Taylor got killed. And now, if you guys remember, Breonna Taylor was first. She was before Ahmaud Arbery and before George Floyd. Just her story was kind of kept quiet, that there was this shooting by the police in Louisville at a drug home. And I heard about it maybe 2 days after it happened. I've been real big on what the Fourth Amendment is. And so when they killed Breonna Taylor, that woke that same feeling that I had lost maybe from the little girl from Oklahoma City bombing.
Mm-hmm.
It woke that same thing up in me, that I had to be of service because that woman should not be dead. They shouldn't even have been in her home. Why are the police in this country during a pandemic serving up drug warrants? Because they can't stop feeding the private and the prison beast. And I knew this. I've been watching Fourth Amendment audits for years and been very much involved because I knew neo-Nazis who became cops. And I was always trying to like let people know that dude's a neo-Nazi. Like, and some of them got fired. Neo-Nazis want to become cops because they know it's a racist job. You get to beat black people. You get to give them felonies so they can't, you know, get a charge with felonies so they can't ever vote or they can't ever own a gun. And I was in meetings back in the day where they talked about we should all become cops. We should all become military. And a bunch of my guys became cops.
Wow.
So I was like, we got to work against this. And one of the things that could stop all of this, the training that officers get to charge our cars has broken America and broken policing. If you see a broken tail light, just give a person a ticket. But they're not trained to do that no more. They're trained to try to look to get you out of your car so they can violate your Fourth Amendment and search your car and try to look for a crime on you. So that leads to a lot of suburban cops doing that to Black people all the time. Right. Whenever they come through in the neck of the woods, they find any reason to pull them over so they could search their car. And I know people have huge thoughts about this. Like, well, then all the drug dealers are going to get away. All the drug dealers get away anyway. For the one you catch, there's 20 other anyway.
Yeah.
It's just become a way of cops being able to bully and intimidate us. So for one, we need to stop with that. One of the really important things is if they can't search our cars no more, or look for a reason, and they're not trained to look for them reasons anymore, it's going to add to officer safety, not take away from. Because now people are not going to have half a gram of coke in their car and think, I'm going to shoot it out with this cop, so I don't have to go back to the mass incarceration system. Right? So it's officer safety. It leads to officer safety. Our civil servants should not be above us, and they have changed the rules with a couple of court hearings. We have to remember, traffic stops are our main interaction with police in this country. It starts with giving us back our Fourth Amendment. Humanity stepped up and beat Donald Trump. And I know there's 74 million other people that voted for him, and I know we have to help change those people because they are American citizens too. But I want people to look and love this country. We can get the bad out by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And we could do the same thing with policing. Go back to the Bill of Rights, which is our Fourth Amendment, which was written specifically so the police or the government at hand cannot look for crimes on us. You see, if you go watch any of the Fourth Amendment audits on YouTube, it's a real problem, and we can fix it. And the Trumpers should even be on our side because it's a constitutional Bill of Rights issue.
Totally, you know? Totally. I'm always surprised that's the one that they've decided they don't care about.
You're right. Yeah, I know. Weird. They love that Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Look, for so long, white people in America have gotten into the life raft of America. And we pulled the ladders out of the water so no one else can get in with us. And the cops stand and guard those ladders of the life raft.
Right.
And that is the suburbs. And so the cops' jobs is to protect those ladders. And I'm telling you, this movement, this time, this people in America, we're done. We're moving the cops and pushing the ladders back in the water to let all of us in. Because once we're all in this boat, there is enlightenment. There is enlightenment for all of us to be equal.
Policing is such a complicated issue, and we could talk about it for hours. You know, so much we could get into about having people who specialize in mental health who are being called instead of the police, or actually getting people help with their addiction instead of just sending them to jail. It's just such a complicated thing. But I really think it's so cool that you've taken this on. And I feel like, I don't know, I really appreciate that this is your mission now. I think it's really cool. That's all.
Yeah. Thank you. And I got to give all credit to God. I used to have an old saying that I used to always go, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. And I say that all the time. That was like my saying. I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. And now I got to think that I'm not much, but I'm all God gave me. And if I'm here to fight racism the way that I can, I'm going to do it.
Well, my last question is, what happened to G? What happened to Keith? Do you still keep in touch with them?
Okay, so G, I've never found. Tony, we found a couple other guys, because after my book came out, actually a couple of them were in prison, and then they got a hold of my publisher. I think G's probably dead. He was a man. He was a mouthy kid, man. He ran his mouth. So I don't know. Keith is still alive. There's actually a cool documentary about me and Keith on YouTube that someone made, and they brought me and Keith back together after like 15 years. I met him at the furniture store, and we had great conversation, and everything I just said, Keith will back up. He's still a big Flyers fan, just like I am. So
we will definitely need to be hydrated before we watch that on YouTube, because crying will be rampant.
Yep. So I just have one last question. What would you say to someone who maybe they have fallen into a neo-Nazi ideology and they are questioning and they don't have anyone to turn to validate their questioning? Is there somewhere that people can go? Is there someone they can reach out to?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch of groups out there. There's like Life After Hate, there's Free Radical. I mean, there's like five different groups that do intervention type stuff mm-hmm. now. But really, if you're listening to me, I mean, I don't want nothing from you but for your life to get better. So just get a hold of me on Twitter. Get a hold of me on Facebook. And I will happily correspond with you. It's not about proving their old beliefs wrong. It's just about showing that there's a better life when you're not full of hate and anger and you know, ego. If you just let it go. And if you have any belief in a higher power or God at all, you cannot be a racist. You can't, because God, we were all God's children. Living a life of service to others and caring about other people's feelings. And what type of life do you want to live? You know, how do you want to be good towards each other? Do you want to have a great life? I mean, America is a beautiful country, and we are so amazing at the way that this has worked out to where we are fixing ourselves during this pandemic that I think America has great things to come.
Amen. Tell us the name of your book again, Frank.
Yep. So my book is Autobiography of Recovering Skinhead. And I also work with a Black-owned business here in Los Angeles. They are called Public Statement Apparel. And we put out shirts for allies. Like, there's a Lifetime Ally shirt. There's a bunch of stuff. And this is a Black-owned business. So it's the money for this type of stuff is staying in the movement of people that were really trying to change. And so go look them up on Instagram. They're called Public Statement Apparel.
Where can we find you on social media?
Frank Mink, Twitter. Or you can find Autobiography of Recovering Skinhead page on Facebook or on Instagram too. So my last name spelled real weird. Remember, it's M-E-E-I-N-K. I'm pretty not hard to find.
Awesome.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Thank you guys. Thanks for having me. Thanks for taking the time.
Okay. Wow. What an interview. What a guy. Well, it's come to that time of the evening. It's not evening. It's come to that time of the episode when I ask you, Megan, I mean, I know you're not going to become a white supremacist. I just know that about you. But do you think that if you were in his position, you're 13 years old, coming from a really rough childhood, do you think you would be susceptible to this group of people that's telling you
totally
that you matter?
When I was 13, I was really viciously bullied, and it was the worst time of my life. And I think it will be the worst time no matter what happens to me in the future.
Aww.
Just so terrifying. Was sick every night before I went to school. If there was a group of people who would be like, hey, you're cool, like, we care about you, just don't like this. It's not really in my nature to do that, but I can't say 100% that at a very super young age, I wouldn't at least pretend to. So,
I can't remember if I've said this on the show yet, but when I was 13, I was so desperate for friends that I prayed to Satan.
Okay.
And mind you, I'm like still technically fucking Mormon.
Wow.
And I'd been praying to God for friends, and God hadn't been delivering.
Not delivering, no.
And I was so lonely, dude. I was so lonely. And it wasn't like nobody liked me, but I just was at this school and nobody just really cared. Like, I just didn't have a friend group. And I literally was like, all right, Satan, I will pledge my allegiance to you instead of God if you just give me some fucking friends. He didn't deliver either.
Wow. That is really bad when you give your soul to Satan for friends and you still can't get friends.
Eventually, I made some friends. Maybe we have Satan to thank for that. I don't know.
Oh, God.
The point of this story is that when you're that desperate for community at that young of an age, especially, you go to more desperate lengths than people really feel comfortable admitting to, I think, to feel like they belong somewhere. And I think it would be ignorant to claim that any one of us is just so inherently good that we're exempt from that, you know? Well, obviously, we need to take this opportunity to say that Black Lives Matter. And
yeah.
We're just like trying to show that ideology can happen to anyone, no matter how bad or extreme, if somebody is in the like perfect moment in their life where they're vulnerable.
Yeah. Just kind of looking at how we can stop it happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Frank's done some really great work, and there are a lot of great organizations out there. I think it's important to look at stories like this, honestly, and try to learn from them and try to view them like antibodies of sorts, you know? That's all.
Well, follow Frank. Follow us. What's your Twitter and Instagram and all that for you to have some friends?
Please. I'm lonely. My Instagram is oolalola, OOHLALOLA, and Twitter is oolalola with one O, OHLALOLA.
Got it. Mine is vibehirebitch on Instagram.
We have a website now, so yes. Check us out at trustmepod.com.
Share with your friends. Thank you guys so much for listening. Remember this week to follow your gut, watch out for red flags, and never,
ever trust me.
Bye.